The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Book Club, our live edition of the podcast where each month an author discusses their work in front of an audience. I'm Claire Armitstead. In this edition, John Mullen speaks to John Banville in his second appearance at the book club. But whereas his first was under his own name, this time Banville was using his crime writing pseudonym, Benjamin Black. The reason soon became clear, for he was discussing his resurrection of Raymond Chandler's famous detective, Philip Marlowe, for his 2014 novel, The Black-Eyed Blonde. We'll hear the Booker Prize winner discussing his love of Chandler's original novels, the legacy of F. Scott Fitzgerald, and the role of the author in the golden age of Hollywood. But to begin with, John Mullen asked Banville why he chose to step into Raymond Chandler's gumshoes in the first place.
Because I was asked to do it. Yeah. The Raymond Chandler estate said, would you like to write a Philip Marlowe novel? And actually, they asked me about 5 or 6 years ago, and I said, no, I didn't really want to do it. But then they came back with improved terms if I would do it. And I thought, yeah, I'll do it. It's an adventure. I feel when I'm doing these Benjamin Black things, I feel I'm probably destroying my reputation forever, you know. But it's fun. I enjoyed doing it. It was I've always admired Chandler. I first started reading him when I was in my teens. My brother introduced me to it. And it was a wonderful discovery that you could write this kind of prose in crime fiction. And it was a challenge. It killed the summer for me. So it was fun.
Because the Benjamin Black books, and you've written this under that nom de plume, but the Benjamin Black books, I think quite a lot of people who've read them have felt that even though they are, of course, something different from your other novels. But even though there are two strings to your bow, the strings seem quite entwined, really.
Do they?
Yes, I think they do. Whereas stylistically, this is, you know, a completely different thing, isn't it? You have tried to write...
Well, I didn't want to just be a plastic replica of Chandler. I first of all set out, and I remember writing to my publisher in America and saying, you know, Marlowe really has to be brought up to date, and we have to, you know, move him on and develop him. And then when I went back and read some of the books, I thought, no, you can't interfere with this. It would be like making Bertie Wooster into a clubber of the 2000s or something. It couldn't be done. Marlowe is of a piece and of his time, and the style is the style. I thought, well, you know, I'll have to have four-letter words and have to have what people actually say. And I thought, no, can't do that. Because as much more stylish as it is, there's that weary sense of Chandler saying, oh, God, I have to obey the rules of my time. I have to obey the censorship laws, the laws of etiquette, the laws of decency. And I thought, no, I have to observe those as well, even though they don't hold anymore. But I had to do it as Chandler would have done it. And that was both interesting and limiting. When you read Chandler, when you read it very closely, as I did, you can see the points in which he gets bored. You can see the points in which he's very badly hungover. And the strange thing about Chandler is that he really did despise himself. He felt that he was capable of much grander stuff than this. But actually, what he had done, I mean, he's made a character that will live through the ages as long as, you know, Bertie Wooster or Leopold Bloom or Charles Swann. He's made a character for all time. It didn't satisfy him. He wanted to do more. He's a very strange, unhappy, complicated man. One of the spurs for me to do this book was a friend of mine, Argentinian novelist living in Spain, who was a great Chandler fan. He said, you know, the odd thing about Marlowe is that the only person he ever loves in any of the books is Terry Lennox. Mm. And I think that's true. He goes to bed with various women and so on, but Terry Lennox is the love of his life. I think many of the writers of that period were all mesmerized by The Great Gatsby, and they wanted to redo The Great Gatsby. and do it better. And I think that's what Chandler was always doing. And The Long Goodbye, in which Terry Lennox appears, and I think The Long Goodbye is, it may not be the best of the Marlowe novels, but it's certainly the most interesting of them. That is very romantic and very, very Gatsby-esque.
Mm. It's funny you mentioned the sort of the swearing, because when I was reading your book, it reminded me of how, because of the times in which they were written, how comparatively chaste, actually, the Chandler novels are. And even in terms of, there are people who are having lots of sex, sometimes of a kind of bad kind. And, you know, the plot of his first novel, I think, was the first time I saw the word nymphomaniac in print. But actually, Marlowe himself, he usually turns women down, doesn't he? I think
he does. Well, I think Marlowe, that's what I was hinting at earlier. I think Marlowe, like Chandler, was, to use that great modern world, I think he was conflicted in his sexuality. He had a very strange marriage to this woman who was something like 20 years older than he was, but he didn't discover that until they'd been married for a long time and it became more apparent that she was, you know, much older than he was. But he loved her dearly. I think he loved his cats more than he loved her, mind you. A very strange man. Very strange, dark. You know, he didn't start writing these crime things until he was in his 40s. He'd been here in England. He went to Dulwich College, where P.G. Wodehouse went. Then he was in London and wanted to be a poet. Then he went to America and wanted to be a journalist there. Then he became an oil man. He worked for an oil company. He was fired from the oil company for moral turpitude, essentially, because he fancied the secretaries much too much. He was also congenitally lazy and was always late for work. So he was fired from the oil company. But he was a strange, dark, and very much a man of his time, in the same way that Marlowe is very much a man of his time. One of the odd things that Chandler never deals with is that Marlowe doesn't go to the war. He's probably a bit too old, but even so, Chandler never mentions this. People are all fighting in Europe or fighting in Spain, but Marlowe is not doing any of
that. Yeah, because in The Long Goodbye, it's sort of half the characters have been in a foxhole together, haven't they?
Oh, yeah, and Marlowe doesn't seem to feel any sense of guilt or, you know, having shirked his duty. So it's strange. Chandler himself had been in the First World War. And as he said, you know, when you've led a platoon of men over the top into a barrage of machine gun fire, nothing else in life is ever going to be the same. So again, there was that darkness, but people in those times, they didn't examine themselves in the way that we do now. They simply accepted, I shouldn't say simply, they accepted life far more readily than we do, and they accepted the circumstances of their lives.
It's different because it's Los Angeles and not Dublin, but it's the 1950s. I mean, Benjamin Black novels take us back to the 1950s. Do you have a penchant for that decade? Do you think that there are things which are kind of clearer for a novelist or easier for a novelist?
Well, I mean, certainly if you know, for noir fiction, the 50s is a wonderful period. But it's sort of, certainly in Ireland and to a certain extent in America as well, it's sort of the forgotten decade. It was supposed to be the decade in which we would find ourselves and we would live fully, having gone through this terrible war, instead of which it was a mean, dry, desiccated, poverty-stricken decade, spiritually and to a certain extent financially. In Ireland, certainly, it was an appalling time. I grew up, I was born in 1945, so in the middle 50s, I was 10. And I remember it vividly. It was absolutely awful. But to write about, it's absolutely fascinating. Where we are now in Ireland, that comes in the 50s. That's where that started, that authoritarianism, that non-militaristic fascist state that Ireland was, well, really from 1937 on. But let's not get too far back into that.
But what about 1950s California. Is that, I mean, did you, when you were imagining that, was there anything apart from the Raymond Chandler novels themselves you felt you had to kind of work out?
Well, I suppose, I'd never thought about it before, but I suppose it was the old movies.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up on black and white Hollywood movies in the 40s and 50s. My wife was American. I remember when she came to Europe first, she said, "It's so unfair." She said, "You speak American because you've been watching these movies all your life." I said, "I don't speak English or Irish English because there are no movies to teach me how to speak that language." Well, we knew the sound of it. We knew the shape of it. Of course, we knew nothing about American life, really. But it was so sexy. I mean, you know, there's a wonderful, you were talking about earlier about the chasteness of those of that time. There's a wonderful scene in Double Indemnity where Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck, they sit down on a couch, they smoke a cigarette, they blow some smoke in each other's faces. Then there's a fade. And then it comes back, and they're sitting at either end of the same sofa, obviously sated, but nothing has happened in between. They're still wearing their clothes, they still have their shoes on, everything is in place, but you know what's happened. And I like that. I mean, it's much more convincing than a couple of actors climbing on top of each other as they do nowadays. And you know that they're not doing sex anyway, so why show it on the screen, apart from the fact that everybody wants to see this woman naked or that man naked. But you remember in the movies, it used to be when people kissed that they did it like so. So they didn't actually kiss. They just put their heads in each other's shoulders. Now, it's what my friend Neil Jordan tells me is called in Hollywood face fucking. You know, where, you know, kissing is so, I don't think human beings kiss the way people kiss on screen now. It's like two underwater animals. So you And I can't watch it. I just can't watch it. Maybe it's my age, but I just find it ugly, and I certainly don't find it erotic. That's, as I say, to go back to the very beginning, that's why I decided that I would have to keep the formula that Chandler had and the formula that the 50s imposed on him, to keep it chaste. I mean, I'm doing a television series at the moment, starting to write it. Set in Nice at the moment and so on. And I've written an entire hour-long episode in which there's not one four-letter word. And I can see people saying, as in the old days, people said, "Well, you can't use that language." Now people are saying, "Why can't we have more foul-mouthed people?" And I'm going to stick to it. I'm going to say, why not get back to a thing where people are not eating each other's faces and saying the most awful things to each other? I mean, I'm so tired. Aren't you people saying, you know, "What the fuck?" And, you know, the screen violence, which we love. I mean, The Sopranos is a wonderful series. But one of the reasons that people keep watching is they know that every 10 minutes or so there's going to be some serious violence or some serious sex. Maybe we should try something where, you know, you're not giving that, you're not throwing sweets to the kids. You know, saying, you know, "No, do without the sweets."
They have that warning, which is, of course, a promise, not a warning, on the BBC dramatisations where they say...
Oh, yeah.
There's a great phrase, which I'm afraid does stir my juices.
Yes,
where
everybody...
Where they say there will be scenes of violence, scenes of a sexual nature, and obscene language right from the start.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and when it's right from the start, you know, everybody, quick!
Before I've fallen asleep, I've got all the good stuff.
Yeah. But what about the other sort of, I mean, these are sort of negative things in a way. When you obviously read your way through Chandler before writing this novel.
And no, I didn't.
No, you read some of it.
I went back and read a couple of the books.
But you must have... Did you have a sort of... I mean, I don't want you to give away a modus operandi if you don't want to, but you must have had a kind of a list, maybe even a list on a bit of paper, of his sort of tropes and tricks and habits. Or did it...
Oh, no.
No?
Oh, you mean of Marlowe's?
Of Marlowe's of Chandler.
There's a wonderful,
yes, of Marlowe's.
There's a wonderful letter. Marlowe's. There's a wonderful letter that Chandler wrote in reply to a reader. It's a 2 or 3 page letter in which he gives everything he knows about Marlowe, which is not very much. Mm. And that was invaluable for me. But apart from that, no. I mean,
You didn't have the Chandler next to you while you were writing?
Oh, God, no. I mean, that would be... I would be a parrot then. I would have somebody saying,
yeah,
you know, Polly wants a cracker. Yes, Polly wants a cracker. I couldn't do that. I had to write it. I want to write The Spirit of Chandler. My Marlowe, I think, is probably more melancholy. Mm. And...
even more melancholy.
Yeah, he's... and he's less tough. I don't believe... when Chandler... I can see that every now and then he says, oh, God, I better make him beat somebody up or get beaten up or something. I don't believe that. The books are more interesting when Marlowe is being vulnerable and trying to do his best, trying to be decent, trying, you know... And my brother, who's a great fan of Chandler, who, as I said, introduced me to him, he loves... Chandler's metaphors, you know, as he was as unobtrusive as a tarantula on a slice of angel cake. I think those are overworked. That's not Chandler at his best. That's Chandler with a hangover. Chandler at his best is where he's just writing quite plainly, but with that, I was going to say inimitable style, but of course I have imitated it. But there's an essence to Chandler that's inimitable.
I think you must have quite a... well, you obviously do have an unusual gift for pastiche or for remembering the patterns of a particular writer's kind of sentences.
Well, it's funny you should say, because I had lunch today with John Simenon, who's Georges Simenon's son, and I was saying that I did that book, the Chandler Marlowe book, but I couldn't do a Simenon. Because Simenon really, he has such a subtle style that it's almost not a style. Whereas Chandler is all style. Mm. The stronger a style, the easier it is to speak in that voice. But I wouldn't attempt a Simenon book, even a Maigret book.
But do you think maybe that's because you've been reading it in translation, so it's...
No. Even in translation, he really is inimitable. I certainly couldn't do his Simenon's spareness. You know, I was reading one of the Maigret books recently, and he's just talking about Maigret is walking around. He's come to the village where he was born to investigate a crime, and he's walking about, and it's winter, and he just comes to a corner, and he's walking with somebody. He said, and just then, they caught the scent of chrysanthemums, and it is absolutely perfect. It's absolutely perfect. And I realized that, and this might be interesting to talk about, that it struck me that Simenon is a tragic poet. But Chandler, and I think this is one of the reasons for Chandler's self-hatred, he knew he couldn't achieve that level of poetic intensity. I think because of self-loathing. And the feeling that he should have been a poet, or he should have been this. You know, the thing about Simenon was he was a poet without... I mean, I can't imagine. I doubt Simenon ever wrote a line of verse in his life. But he is, I think, a tragic poet.
But there are things that Chandler via Marlowe did, which you duly do in the novel, and which may, and with some kind of, I mean, some kind of relish, it seems to me. So, for instance, Philip Marlowe, he's great on people's clothes, isn't he? Especially women's clothes.
Oh, yeah.
So, you read it, and you knew you had to do that, didn't you? And because it's the 1950s, and it's LA, they can wear things like, this is a man, cream jodhpurs, calfskin boots, a shirt so white it glowed, and a yellow silk cravat. And that's the kind of abominable husband of the sort of femme fatale.
I wish we could dress like that now. Chandler was fascinated by, as you say, especially by women's clothes. He described men's clothes, but the women's clothes he really knew.
Yeah.
I mean, he knew the texture of the cloth that their clothes were made from, which I find, again, fascinating. There's something slightly creepy about it. But I like that creepiness.
So you must have had a mental sort of list of things like that needed to be part of the book. Because
the worst thing you could do is make a list of anything, because then you would simply be, it would be mechanical. What I had to do was to put myself in the place of Chandler. But the odd thing is, I wrote it over a summer, and I cannot remember writing it. I can remember the summer and I can remember having done, but I cannot remember doing it. So I think I did it in some sort of state of, I don't know, automatic writing. But I've read since, he said that what you can, people are capable of self-hypnotism. You can hypnotize yourself into doing a thing when you have to do something that's very specific and very concentrated and intense. You can hypnotize yourself. And I suspect that that's, I think I was in a state of self-hypnosis for that summer when I wrote that.
Don't you think maybe it was also an easier sort of self-hypnosis for you to do because Marlowe is, despite the gap of time and nationhood between you and Chandler, you say your Marlowe's more melancholy than Chandler, but he's in essence a bit of a Banville character, isn't he? I mean, he's a puzzled spectator of other people's passions, as it were, isn't he? And I mean, that always happens in a Chandler novel. I realise reading your novel that was a hallmark for me of Chandler, that he's very worldly wise, he's knocked around, he's seen what people are like, and yet he's always, in the final twist at the end, rather amazed that the motivation, the explanation for what's happened is based on somebody's passionate feelings, which he hasn't originally divined,
That's a good point. I mean, what fascinated me about Marlowe is that he is solitary. He has nothing. He's no family. The only possessions he seems to have are a coffee pot and a chess set. He lives in rented accommodation. He's no friends. He has a drink with the odd cop, but he has no respect for him. He's this entirely solitary creature. And he is as close as fiction in our time has come to the Arthurian legends. I mean, he is the knight. You know, that wonderful Dürer print of Knight, Death, and the Devil. The man sitting on his horse riding death on one side and the devil on the other. And he's steadfastly moving forward. That's how Marlowe saw himself. That's how Chandler saw him. But what I love about it is that Marlowe recognized his own weaknesses. And one of the reasons that Bogart became Chandler, and Bogart only made one movie. I mean, we forget this. There was only one movie in which he was Marlowe. But he became Marlowe so much because he was too old, he was too short. You know, it's wonderful in The Big Sleep, Carmen Sternwood says to him, "You're very tall, aren't you?" And he says, "You know, I can't help it," or something. In the movie, she has to say to him, "You're not very tall, are you?" And he says, "Well, I try to be," which is a wonderful piece of... But there's also a thing where he shoots the guy at the end of it. He shoots somebody. And he's driving away, and his hands are shaking. And he says to Lauren Bacall, "You know, I've just shot a man." That was almost unheard of in movies in those days, because of course shooting people was a click, bang, no blood, no anything. People went, dead. But he gave acknowledgement to the fact that he had done something terrible. And there was also the pathos, of course, between Bogart and Bacall, that first of all, they were in love. They were completely inappropriate. Bogart was in his 40s. She was 19 when they made their first movie together. I think she was 21, 22 in The Big Sleep. He's in his 40s, but you can see the air crackling between them. Poor Marlowe never found a woman, never found Lauren Bacall, never did. But I think what he found was Terry Lennox, the love of his life.
And in we had some discussion about whether to how much I was allowed to give away about the plot and the ending. And John said he was totally relaxed about it. But I mean, I think it's safe to say, without giving away everything, that in this novel, Marlowe, you know, he does that thing, doesn't he, of saying to you, "Oh, this woman, she's too good for me. I don't know why I'm falling for her. I'm a fool." And then she fools him, you know. And then at the end of the novel, he realizes that the woman he's fallen for is in some ways the person who's engineered things.
Yes, but I think one of the pivotal scenes in the book, and I realized it when I was reading the proofs, is at the end when, oh, what the hell, you know, when Terry Lennox comes back, steps out from behind the curtain, and he and Marlowe are chatting, and the woman is sitting, and she suddenly stands up and says, what are you doing? And of course, it's a pair of old lovers meeting after a long time apart. There's no sex involved. It's not that kind of love. But it's, in a way, it's a deeper love. It's the kind of love that the poor, what's her name, Claire? She could never get that kind of love from Marlowe. It's that thing they believed in those days, that male bonding thing, you know. You know, you see it in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and so on. These two beautiful Hollywood men are really in love with each other. Nobody can. There are these silly scenes with that pretty girl.
Yes.
But nobody believes.
With Sacha Distel singing.
Yeah. Nobody believes for a moment that she's going to come between them. This is just a little.
Isn't it? I can't remember if in this film it is, but in your novel it certainly is forged on drink, really. This is a very true to the original in that it's an alcohol-saturated novel.
They were soaked in drink in those days. I mean, again, my wife said, you know, that her uncle and his wife, they would have four or five martinis, you know, before they started drinking. It's sort of like Ireland, you know? But it was America, Midwestern, supposedly pure American, but they were sloshing it back.
Well, you'll get Quirk in your other novel. He drinks.
Yeah, but you know, there's a wonderful line in that movie, Postcards from the Age, Meryl Streep and Shirley MacLaine. Shirley MacLaine is playing Meryl Streep's mother, and she's constantly drunk. And Meryl Streep says, you know, at one point, you know, you're an alcoholic. And she says, I'm not an alcoholic. I just drink like Irish people. And that gets a laugh in every cinema in the world. Except in Ireland, people go, yeah. We know what you mean, we know what you mean. But yes, it is soaked in drink. They must have been drunk all the time. And, you know, he'll go in and have a few martinis and a few beers and so on. And then he'll get in the car and he'll drive along Sunset Boulevard. And maybe they absorbed it better than we did. They never seem to take a nap to sleep off the booze. But they did drink a lot in that book. But then Chandler was obsessed by drink. I mean, he was an alcoholic. He was a serious alcoholic.
But that sort of inflects the narrative and the way that the story works, doesn't it? Because one of the things about Marlowe as a narrator, which again recurred to me from Chandler reading your novel, is he's constantly having to kind of get over things and console himself for feeling bad about things and recover from consoling himself about feeling bad about things. And that weariness is not just a sort of tone, it's actually a kind of alcohol experience that runs through the story.
I don't know that that's true. I think that Marlowe is spiritually, I think as a small boy before he started drinking, he would have been infinitely sad. That's what I love about Marlowe, is his deep sadness and his fortitude in dealing with it. Marlowe never feels sorry for himself. This bad thing has happened, I've been betrayed again, but he goes on. We could do with people like him nowadays, people who are just ordinarily brave, ordinarily decent. You know, they're not superheroes, they're not knocking women down and killing terrorist chiefs and so on. They're just doing their best. They're getting along. One of the things that I find, I've said this many times before, one of the things I find very disturbing about crime fiction now, and especially crime fiction on television, is that it is so violent. Every television series you watch, especially the ones from Scandinavia, they all start with some young woman being raped, tortured, murdered, cut into pieces, thrown into a garbage bin. That's the starting premise. That's not good. It's not good for us.
But it's all narrative, though, isn't it? It's not. But I agree with you. But it's not because those things in an old and different kind of crime novel don't happen. I mean, in your novel, a woman is, we think, probably raped, the word's not used, probably tortured, and killed in a horrible way and dumped in a reservoir or a lake or whatever. That has happened to her, And it's quite important in the plot that it's happened to her, those terrible things. But you don't see anything.
No, but the point I'm making is that that's not merely a narrative peg. You don't start... I mean, the victims in crime fiction have no... Well, it was always the case. You know, Agatha Christie's The Corpse in the Library. Nobody ever cared about the corpse. Mm. The person who's killed is, in a way, the most important person in the book, or in the film, or in the television series. That should be the case. This thing has happened to this poor creature.
So that's why you have the meeting between her and Philip Marlowe, because he only meets her once before
I think that's terribly sad, because they could have had something really good going.
And they have a drink.
Yeah, they have a drink, and she's a tough, but she's obviously a nice woman. Obviously a good person, despite being, you know, all these hard-bitten and so on. You can see just for a moment they spot something in each other, and then it's ended. That is, but I would see that as a tragic aspect of it. And again, poor Marlowe, you know, anytime anything comes up that seems to be a chance to be happy or a chance to have some comfort in his life is immediately taken away. He's infinitely sad. But I love him for that.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking, what was characteristic about him as a narrator, and you're right, he's very, very unself-indulgent, but he does, I guess the thing you managed to bring off, which I think must be very difficult, which Chandra himself did manage to do, was to make him unself-pitying whilst saying things that he talks about himself a lot. He's always saying, and he does in your version, oh, what a chump I was, and I don't understand myself, not one little bit, and I get fanciful sometimes, maybe I shouldn't. He says a lot about himself.
But there's much more of that in Chandler as well. I was surprised, I went back, at how introspective Marlowe is. He doesn't seem to me, but he is. He's constantly looking at himself and saying, here I am, a moral being in the world. I have some duty to perform here. I have a duty to live as well as I can, despite the fact that I'm, you know, screwed up spiritually and I'm a drunk and I'm all these things. But I still have to live as well as I can. And he does. I do think popular fiction has some kind of responsibility not to be entirely nihilistic. That's really all I'm saying. I'm not saying it has a moral duty, but I think popular fiction should present a moral character and say, you know, this is a character trying to live a decent life. These are very deep waters, and I don't know what I think about them. Certainly, I mean, if I were talking about a Banville book, I would say I have no responsibilities whatsoever. You know, art is totally immoral.
Yes.
But popular art is not immoral because it reaches so many people. My books don't reach so many people, but, you know, popular art does. I watched the other night Four Weddings and a Funeral, which, you know, is a wonderful movie. It is a wonderful movie.
Discuss, yes.
Well, it's an old 1940s Cary Grant movie.
Yes.
And nobody pretends for a moment that it's a portrayal of real life. But it is saying, look, you have to try to be decent, which is what, I mean, Hollywood played a huge role in getting America out of the Depression, and it played an even bigger role in the American recovery after the Second World War. And this is where Hollywood failed. After the defeat in Vietnam, Hollywood reveled in the defeat instead of saying, come on, let's pull ourselves up. Because Hollywood is one of the most influential voices in America.
Okay, well, we'll extract you from the deep water briefly and give you a chance to anybody here. There's a lady, oh, there's a gentleman there. How many mics have we got? We've got two mics. Okay, so whoever gets the mic first can start. And
yeah, just a question for John about, do you have a preference over Lou Archer or Philip Marlowe or Ross MacDonald over Chandler?
Oh, yes. I mean, Ross MacDonald is Chandler Light, I think. He tries too hard. The kind of things that Chandler does with a flick of the wrist, Ross MacDonald has to labor over. And while I like the books, and also I don't believe in Lou Archer at all. As I believe in Marlowe, I don't believe in Lou Archer. I'm not saying the books are bad, you understand. I'm just saying that compared to Chandler, I think he doesn't rate at all. Not for me, anyway.
Yes, as a lady.
When I think of the 70s, I think of wonderful films like 3 Days of the Condor, The Conversation, All the President's Men, The Parallax View. Is it that America lost confidence in itself, and those films are exemplifying that, which is why somebody like Marlowe couldn't exist in that world?
Yes, that's true. I mean, if you look at the Long Goodbye that what's his name?
Robert Altman.
Robert Altman with Elliot Gould. I mean, Marlowe goes along and shoots Terry Lennox at the end, which is nonsense. Absolute nonsense.
It's a good film, though, is it not? Is it not a good film? No.
It is a good film.
It's one of my favourite films.
It's a good, it's a good, but we're talking about, it's not Marlowe, it's only not Charlie.
A Long Goodbye. But,
Great song. Great song. And,
that's the first time I've sung at a Guardian Book Club.
There you are, see?
Go on. 7 years in, I've finally done it.
It's a good movie, but they were very good movies, but in a way it wasn't Hollywood's job to be paranoid and to say there's a huge conspiracy, they're all doing us down, it's all Watergate. It wasn't all Watergate. I mean, Watergate was a grubby little conspiracy, a few idiots sent in to burgle a place. The whole thing went completely spiraled out of control because that fool Nixon tried to cover it up. I mean, Nixon's great problem is that he had no sense of humor. He should have said, "What? You sent those guys in? For Christ's sake, you know? Let's move on." Hollywood always wants to make a buck. And they said, "All right, paranoia is going to sell." So you had, as you said, the Parallax View and all these movies where half the time you didn't know what was going on, but there were still beautiful people like Warren Beatty, and you watch him in anything, right? But I do think that Hollywood did lose its way, and it was partly to do, as you said, with McCarthyism, that it frightened Hollywood. And also, of course, Hollywood was losing out to television. I mean, Hollywood in the 70s thought it was finished. What's happened in our time is that television, curiously, has become Hollywood. I mean, I was talking to an actor today, we were talking about doing a movie, and he was saying, you know, let's do it on television, because you can't make feature films anymore. You can't get the money, you can't get the backing, you can't get, but you can in television. And it's wonderful that television is so good now. But who would have thought, even 10 years ago, that television would become so good? But again, you watch these wonderful series like The Sopranos or Breaking Bad or something, but they are so nihilistic. They are so bleak. I still think America's the last best hope. Not a very popular notion nowadays, but I do think it is. And it has to find some way to cure itself. Now, probably the movies, the screen, can't do it. But it certainly did in, as I say, after the Depression. If you look at a movie like My Man Godfrey or all those screwball comedies, they were all about the Depression and how to cure it, how to right ourselves. But, of course, one of the things Hollywood had to do after the war was get the women out of the factories and back into the kitchen, into the gingham. And that's where Doris Day was very important, you know. You know, the eternal virgin.
Yes, gentlemen here.
What is it that you think motivates Marlowe? I mean, you said that he's the knight in the Dürer painting. I mean, it's not money. They get the money conversation out of the way within the first chapter, usually, and then that's kind of forgotten.
He never
about.
Gets the money.
No, he doesn't get paid.
And in the Chandler novels, you know, it's $100 a day plus expenses or whatever it is. What is it that motivates him? Because he carries on and he carries on and he carries on, despite being duped, drugged, beaten up, right to the end.
Oh, I think it's relatively simple. I think that, as I've said a few times now, Marlowe has almost nothing. No family, no loved ones. He is not loved. He has no one to cherish him. We all need someone to cherish us. and someone whom we may cherish. Marlowe hasn't got that. Chandler had his cats. Marlowe hasn't even got a cat. All he has is this...
In the Oldman film he has.
Yeah, I know. Another reason to... he only has this sense of himself as a decent human being. The decency. This is a concept we never talk about nowadays. It's like talking about beauty, you know. Beauty now, you mention the word beauty now, it's like mentioning sex in the Victorian era. People get embarrassed. And decency is another of those words. But decency is still the standard to which we all try to live, whether we know it or not. And this is the only thing Marlowe has, is his essential decency. He deals with these corrupt, grubby people, sad people, people who've lost their way. He hasn't lost his way. This is his great... He is that knight riding through the plague-ridden city saying, you know, I will keep going on. It's admirable. It may be. It's possible. It's certainly easy to fall into sentimentality in this, but I don't think we should think that way. I think that, you know, we should go back to notions of decency.
So he sort of starts with nothing, ends with nothing. He traverses the book almost with a light touch, leaving with nothing at the end of it. I mean, he's that kind of angelic quality in that he's just sort of there as the.
Yes, but also you have to realize that, think about it, that's every man's dream. I have gone through this, I've met this wonderful woman, I've righted these wrongs, I've been decent, and I'm unencumbered, I'm free.
Do you not think also, I mean, there's the Sherlock Holmes thing as well, that it's boredom. I mean, quite often at the beginning of a Raymond chapter, I opened The Little Sister, I think it is, just and read it for half an hour this afternoon. And at the beginning, he's been chasing a blue bottle around his office. And he's spent quite a lot of time doing that. There's nothing else. And then, isn't it a bit like, I mean, this isn't to undermine the decency. Down these mean streets a man must go, he's not himself, mean stuff. But it's also the Sherlock Holmes thing that he waits for something to come to, and it's usually a woman, it's not always, and... something, you know, and then the plot comes in. He waits for the plot. He doesn't go looking for it, does he? He waits for it. And
yeah,
it comes
I mean, but that's we could talk about that as well. I mean, I've always felt that boredom, and more specifically, the fear of boredom, is one of the great forces in human affairs. It's unacknowledged. We would do anything not to be bored. We would kill. We would slaughter, we would start up revolutions in order not to be bored. And yes, that is a force in his life as well. He spends most of his time in that awful office, bored out of his mind. And then this woman in this pencil skirt comes along and she says, find my man for me. And he's off. He doesn't care about the money.
It's often said we like our heroes to have flaws. What are Marlowe's?
Oh, God, Marlowe is a walking flaw. drink, of course. Inability to make a commitment to anybody. I mean, he is a solitary, but, you know, he's a solitary by choice as well as by accident. I mean, I grew up in Ireland in the 1950s with a deep sense of sin. You were a good person. You were a clean soul, and then you committed a sin. And you were smeared with filth. And then you went to confession at the end of the week, and you confessed. And you came out, and you were clean again. It was a wonderful system. I miss it. I miss it greatly. I wish I could do it. But Marlowe doesn't have that, you know. Marlowe knows how awful the world is. Because the books in which we read about Marlowe is, you know, this particular case. There are 20 other cases which are unbelievably grubby. I mean, he doesn't do divorce cases. I always think that's a bit of a... I think he does, actually. He just pretends he doesn't, because that's where the money is. So he knows what the world is like, and he doesn't pretend to be... You know, I've spoken of him as, you know, the last of the knights and so on. And he sees himself to that. But he knows that inside that suit of armor, there's a shivering human being who is no better than anybody else, maybe slightly worse. So he's all flaw. That's what's attractive about him, to me anyway.
You said that Terry Lennox was Marlowe's love. Do you think also that the other love interest in the books is Los Angeles itself? Because he waxes very lyrical about Los Angeles, and you know, you get a palpable sense of being there when Chandler's describing the city. And because it was on the crux of change at the time he was writing these books.
Yeah, yeah, he writes very well about, and he conjures up Los Angeles almost without writing about it. It's just in the background. You feel it. You feel that heat. You feel that strange, humid climate. You can see the palm trees. And, of course, because he's a stranger, I mean, he was born in Chicago, I think, educated in England, fought in the Canadian Army in the war. So, he ended up in California about the age of 40, so he was a stranger to the place. And it must have been extraordinarily beautiful and stylish and romantic then. You know, he was... you remember in the movie Chinatown where Jack Nicholson, the character, says... He's talking to somebody, he says, you know, you've got to be careful because Los Angeles, this is a small town. And it would still have been a small town then. Now it's sprawls, but then it would have been a small, intimate place. Yes, it is a character, you're quite right. It's a love object, not a love object from Marlowe.
Do you think that's also something to do with the way that in a novel set in Los Angeles or set in 50s Los Angeles, you're always, as in your novel and in Chandler novels, you're always driving somewhere, aren't you? And
Oh, yes.
You don't, you know, in films, they show you these moody things of people driving, but in novels, they don't. You drive somewhere. So it has this kind of funny thing, doesn't it? Sort of, I found him in a low dive off La Cienega, you know, and you're there. And so it's kind of this strange sort of...
Yeah, because Los Angeles is a whole bunch of villages connected by highways. I was there a couple of years ago doing a book thing, and I was being driven here and there, and I would say, are we still in Los Angeles? They'd say, of course we are. Because I would feel that we were, we've been driven out into the country, into another town, but it's still Los Angeles. It's a big, incoherent town. It has no center, which is one of the delightful things about it. I used to think it was a terrible thing about it, but actually I've realized now that's what makes it so interesting, that there is no center. You can never say, I'll see you, you know, in Trafalgar Square. There's no Trafalgar Square in Los Angeles.
Yes, a gentleman.
Which one is your favourite Marlowe book, and which one do you think is the best?
My favourite is A Long Goodbye, but it's sort of all over the place. It's his most deeply felt book. I think the best of them is The Lady in the Lake. It's very strange, very dark, very bitter book. Very few wisecracks, a lot of deep, deep unhappiness, and I think it's his, and technically also, I think it's his best book.
The Long Goodbye. Have you read The Long Goodbye, sir? I mean, a few times. I mean, it's. I was thinking, because John's novel is in a way a sequel to The Long Goodbye, and The Long Goodbye does turn, although it's fantastic, it turns on some things which. Well, I was going to say Agatha Christie wouldn't dare do, but she did. Which are the plastic surgery, the guy who returns and he's had plastic surgery, and then you realise who it really is.
That's absurd. That was one of his hangover mornings. He should never have done that. Because apart from anything else, no matter what plastic surgery does, it can't do anything to your eyes. The eyes are how you recognise a person. He was writing at a different time, a time when that kind of thing was expected. The denouement, look at Sherlock Holmes, which is full of the most awful absurdities. Sherlock Holmes himself disguises himself, and Watson doesn't recognize him, you know? His lover doesn't recognize him.
He's very resourceful.
We were talking earlier on about the other similar writers there. What about Robert B. Parker? Because he actually finished
one of the
Chandler.
Could you tell
Poodle Spring?
People here who don't know.
Robert B. Parker... he's written a whole series of detective novels by with his hero is Spencer, with an S, like the poet. And there's an awful lot of similarities in the whole style and everything like that to Chandler. And he did actually finish, I think, an unfinished book that Chandler left.
Poodle Springs.
Poodle yeah. Springs, yes. So,
I don't like his work. I'm sorry. I, I think it's rather crude. Sorry, that's all
yes,
I can say.
Yeah, because he starts off very violent and gets less and less so as time goes on. It very much changes the character.
I should read. Tell me later when I should read, and I'll give him another try.
I mean, okay, they're potboilers, but they're great fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be said for the fun of a potboiler. Jesus, I wish I could do it. Oh, to write a potboiler.
It's a gentle.
And there was a Radio 4 play about Billy Wilder and Chandler cooperating on the script for Double Indemnity.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that was a good play.
During it, Bob Wilder says, "Today I did something unheard of in Hollywood. I apologized to a writer." And were writers really that badly thought of in Hollywood? And did this contribute to Chandler's low self-esteem?
Oh, yes. I mean, I quote Gore Vidal, "Hollywood never destroyed anybody worth saving." I mean, people like Faulkner and Chandler would go to Hollywood. Strike an attitude. I am a great writer. I mean, what did they expect from Hollywood? Hollywood is a popular medium. It was run by people who had no pretensions to doing anything other than making a buck. The wonderful thing about Hollywood art is that it's accidental, or was accidental in those days. Nobody thought of himself as an auteur, or, you know, he was just a guy making a movie. First of all, the movies were made in about 3 or 4 weeks. If the first director wasn't doing too well, they'd simply sack him and get somebody else in, and the whole thing would just go on at 9 o'clock in the morning. I mean, it was a factory. And these people, you know, Scott Fitzgerald complained that he'd done a script and only one line of his got onto the screen. I always thought, what did you expect? You know, one line, you're doing pretty good if you got it on intact. I mean, they always interfere. But that's the point about Hollywood. It's a popular art, quote-unquote, but it's popular stuff. So I don't know what they expected.
They got some good people writing, didn't they? I mean, I was thinking when you were saying Scott Fitzgerald only got one line in, I don't know if you've ever seen the version of Pride and Prejudice scripted by Aldous Huxley, which is the one with Laurence Olivier in. And almost no Jane Austen gets in. It's all blinking Aldous Huxley.
No, I mean, I always say that I would love to have been one of those Hollywood hacks in a bungalow up in the Hollywood Hills, banging away at a typewriter, you know, with a green eyeshade, writing those wonderful movies. I'd love to have done that, and I would have got paid as well.
With you telling that story about Scott Fitzgerald, I was just remembering how much I used to love the Pat Hobby stories, and he obviously used that experience to portray what he was involved with.
He's an extraordinary writer in that he's going to be an anomaly in the America of his time. He was a complete romantic, but a romantic in the best sense of the word, lowercase r. Something Hemingway couldn't do. I mean, Hemingway never set, none of Hemingway's novels are set in America. He's regarded as a great American writer, but none of his novels are set in America. They're all set in Europe. What Fitzgerald saw was that poetic sadness at the heart of American life. Here was a country that had only been settled for, in his time, what, 150 years. It was still completely incoherent. It was still trying to make a soul for itself. And he caught that, certainly in The Great Gatsby. And, you know, we forget, too, that Fitzgerald was a Midwesterner. In a way, even though The Great Gatsby is set on the East Coast, it's a kind of Midwestern novel. It catches that loneliness, that
everyone
sense of...
Everyone comes from the Midwest.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Everyone comes from the Midwest. And it catches that vastness, that sense of solitude and of... I don't know if there's even a word for it, wistfulness. And he catches it so beautifully. And in the stories, he catches it as well. And even the stories set in Europe are... Again, they're all about America. And, you know, the only person who really followed Fitzgerald, even though he wasn't trying to do it, was Nabokov in Lolita. Lolita catches him. I mean, Lolita is about America more than it's about this little girl. It's about this. Nabokov fell in love. He didn't expect to. And, you know, love, I suppose, is always most interesting when you fall in love with the thing you didn't expect to fall in love with. He expected to find America vulgar and hateful, but he just found it so exquisitely vulnerable and tender. And Nabokov is a straight follow-on from Gatsby. Even as he didn't intend to be, but he is.
You've talked a lot about Philip Marlowe, how you see him as a character, as a knight errant, and as very isolated. I'm wondering what you feel is the essential part of a Philip Marlowe plot and setting, and how that relates to Fitzgerald, because it seems to me that there's a very unromantic, that Marlowe in a way is a deliberately flat character, because he opens up an extremely corrupt society for us where, you know, sleaze, whether you start with the sleaze or the wealth, they always turn out to be connected with each other.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I agree. I mean, Chandler himself really didn't care about, he certainly had no notions of the social role of the artist. I mean, he said it doesn't matter a damn what a book is about. Anything that matters is style. His villains, they always have something really attractive about them. He kind of likes the villains more than he likes the good guys. The two kinds of people that Marlowe likes are the really tough, squalid cops and the bad guys. He doesn't like rich men. He's attracted to rich women, but doesn't really like them. But he admires these. And they are sort of quintessential American types. The charming crook and the tough cop. And he makes a kind of romance out of them that I think is fascinating. Fitzgerald couldn't have done that. I say again, I think that they were all, in their way, rewriting The Great Gatsby. And The Great Gatsby is a sort of seminal 20th century American novel.
But isn't everybody in The Great Gatsby pretty sleazy? I mean, the romance is in the story, isn't it? It's in the way the story's told, but actually not just Gatsby.
No, the romance is in, and this is where it's so like The Long Goodbye, the romance is in the love between Gatsby and the narrator, yes, what's his name? Yes. Nick Carraway. I mean, Nick Carraway is obviously totally in love with Gatsby.
Yeah.
In the same way that Marlowe's in love with Terry Lennox. That's the romance of it, the unattainable love.
Is that why you chose the very difficult denouement for Marlowe, in that he almost never gets laid in the books, but he ends up getting laid, and then it's a horrible trick, really, that you've played on him in some way. It's Terry Lennox who sort of persuades his wife to do it. I mean, given that the two are in love, why did you sort of pick that as a ending?
He does get laid in once in one book, doesn't he?
And he does it quite often.
No, I don't think so. He doesn't. How often does he?
But he does in yours, but it's only so that
He's not really interested in it, you see.
Yeah.
Again, I find him admirable in that he's not interested in women just because he wants to get them into bed. You know, he's not James Bond, but then he actually is interested in women. He likes their. The really interesting women in the Marlowe books are they're bright women. This is where Lauren Bacall was such an emblematic figure, because she's saying to Marlowe, you know, I'm just as bright as you are. I'm just as interesting as you are. I'm just as tough as you are. I can hold my own with you. That was kind of revolutionary for its time, because, you know, the little woman in the kitchen and the man going out dealing with the world. Whereas Marlowe is saying, you're my equal. But, of course, he does get betrayed. I mean, stupidly, Marlowe marries him off in that, you know, the playback. Mm. If I were ever to do another Marlowe book, which I won't, but if I were to do it, I would have him safely divorced.
Perhaps it's time that we gave John a chance to recharge his Chardonnay and gave his voice a break. Thanks very much for all your questions. And I was thinking when you said that, it was a wonderful, really appreciative review, which I looked up again, by Michael Dibden, who's, I think, a very good crime writer, of John's first quirk novel, Christine Falls. And it was a very appreciative review, which sort of said, oh, I'd expected this literary guy, and God, I mean, he says, well, actually, it's really good. And he says, Michael Dibden said at the end, and he uses that very word, potboiler. He says, life's hard enough for us who labour away down in the potboiler room without the toffs from the penthouse suite showing up and acting like they own the place.
That's very good.
I think a very good compliment.
It's a very elegant sentence, too, isn't it?
And I'm sure you'd all want me to thank John very much for coming and talking.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
John Mullen ending this edition of the Guardian Book Club with John Banville. And that's all we have time for today. Next week, we welcome the actor David Soul to the podcast to talk about his new live show, The Passion and Poetry of Pablo Neruda, all about the life and times of the Chilean poet. You can get that episode as soon as it's released by subscribing to our podcast feed. All the information is at theguardian.com/books. Until then, my thanks to John Banville, John Mullen and producer Matt Hill. Thanks to you too for listening. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.
This new year, make a resolution to dust off that big idea. This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the powerful platform that gives you simple tools to create a gorgeous website in minutes. With elegant templates, Getty image integration, and marketing tools, you can make your ideas resonate with the world. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.